the World War II generation calls itself the greatest generation. Now, people are going to say, oh no, they don't call themselves the greatest generation. Well, let me explain something to you. I'm a writer. A writer writes for the market. When Tom Brokaw wrote The Greatest Generation, his book about the World War II generation, the World War II generation snapped it up like hotcakes. And I know those people very well. Now, my uncles who were in World War II, I love dearly. But remember, we're talking here about a generation, not about your beloved grandfather. And as a generation, that group smells the high heavens. Tom Brokaw wrote a book called The Greatest Generation. They snapped it up. They call themselves the greatest generation, and it has always been their attitude. I don't really care whether this upsets you or not, or it insults your beloved grandfather or some such crap as that. I really don't care. The fact this generation was utterly without the slightest trace of moral courage. I was watching a discussion on immigration, and one old guy in his paper hat got up, World War II paper hat, and said, I fought a war so that we wouldn't be keeping people out of this country. Well, I don't think most of the people who fought in World War II would say they were doing it for open borders. But what is more important than this old clown is that there were a number of other people from the World War II generation in that audience, and not one of them contradicted him. They have no moral courage. He was saying what the establishment wanted said. The conservative establishment wants cheap labor. The liberal establishment wants minority votes. And nobody in that dog-like generation was going to contradict him. I remember in the late 1970s hearing Pat Buchanan say on Firing Line that the World War II generation fought to open Europe to third world immigration. Now that sounds a little odd today. It happened. Fortunately, everybody is busy talking about Iraq right now, out of historical context, so nobody's going to notice that. But that was the line of conservatives, because conservatives were still dominated by the greatest generation, and they were without moral courage. The group that calls itself the greatest generation is divided into two general groups, and they are our established political left and political right today. Let's take a look at what formed the World War II generation. They call themselves dog faces. The reason they call themselves dog faces was because that was what basic training was all about in World War II. It was aimed at beating every bit of resistance, thought, anything but obedience out of a man. They said the military makes a man of you. If the military made a man of you, then military training had failed. Military training was aimed, quite specifically, at making a dog of you. Then, after 4 years of obedience training, and I mean that in the exact sense that a dog gets obedience training, except a dog is treated a lot better, 50% of the greatest generation then took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights to go to college. Here were a bunch of people who had already been trained to obey and worship authority. They then began to obey and worship professors. The professors taught them what we call leftism, rule the world by intellectuals. Intellectuals should rule the world. And, of course, every pipsqueak professor thought he was one of those intellectuals who would be planning the economy, rehabilitating criminals, and pulling guilt payments out of white people to the colored world. That is the essence of leftism, is rule by the people like Lenin and Trotsky, neither of whom ever did a day's work in their lives. And the World War II generation came to worship these, and that is called leftism. Then there was the right. The right worships anything in a uniform. They want more money for the military. They want to beat their chests. They run around in their little paper hats. And so the Greatest Generation broke into two groups, one of which worshipped anything in a uniform, the other of which worshipped professors. This sounds simplistic, but there's when you have people who are beaten into being dog-like and then go to college and listen to a bunch of professors talk about how professors should rule the world, that's pretty simplistic. I never saw anything complicated about them. I know these people. I was raised around these people. I saw the world that they produced. I saw their weakness. I never saw any strength in them. They claim that they were great fighters for freedom, side by side with Comrade Stalin. You can tell by the tone of my voice, I don't like these people. I watched them give everything away. I watched them destroy everything I cared about. So this is personal as well as political. When I was in college, these guys would say, well, we've got to surrender. When we were talking about the South, the Confederate flag, the race situation, anything. But they always had this, I'm tough, I'm a real man, I was in World War II, and I say we got to surrender because it's the tough, realistic thing to do. This made me a little sick for people to be demanding surrender as a macho proposition. Since then, I've gotten pretty used to this idea that people call love hate and so forth. But at the time, when I was young, it was pretty disgusting. The World War II generation came along and saved the world, they say. When they came along, there were two famous totalitarian societies. One was the Soviet Union, which they adopted as their own. The other was Nazi Germany. By the time the World War II generation finally got old enough so that its palsied hands could no longer hold on to our national polity, a third of the world was under the control of the communist tyranny. A third of the world, about 1.5 billion people. That is the way that they saved the world. Instead of having two deadly enemies, totalitarians in Germany and Russia, they produced one gigantic, united, worldwide tyranny. That was their method of, quote, saving the world, unquote. In the 1930s, the white man strode the world like a colossus. And as Bob Twain, David Duke's guest on his programs, points out today, after the World War II generation got through backing down on everything, the white World War II generation got through backing down on everything, always beating its chest while it did it. White people had what, as I say, Bob Twain calls the battered white syndrome. That is to say, we have become so beaten down in one generation, and in two now, also the generation that the Greatest Generation raised, they were so incredibly cowardly that white people have a battered white syndrome. You can rape our women, you can invade our borders, you can insult us, you can demand, in fact it is required that you demand that there be a final solution to the white problem, and white people just grovel. All that came as a result of the group that declares itself the Greatest Generation. Let me repeat a typical example that I mentioned before. I was watching a television show the other day when one of these ridiculous little men in his paper hat from World War II there was a debate about immigration, and he stood up and he said, I fought a war so that we wouldn't keep people out of America. Everybody had to listen because he had the little paper hat on. He was part of the Greatest Generation. All right, so some of them say that. So where is the World War II generation person, a number of whom were sitting in that audience, who will stand up and say, I personally didn't fight a war for that. They're not going to do that. They don't have the guts. They never object to this sort of statement. The World War II generation obeys, period. So young people today call themselves left-wingers or right-wingers, but they're absolutely mystified by the fact that we have broken ourselves in Vietnam, we broke ourselves even worse in Iraq, and we're still doing it, because one group, the group that calls itself the conservatives, worships the military, and therefore if the military is in Lower Cubanga fighting for nothing of any use to the United States, but of great use to Israel, then the group that worships uniforms will be all for them, and the group that worships professors wants the military cut back so more money can go into social programs. That's the split, the insane split, American policy got inherited from the Greatest Generation. And right-wingers and left-wingers, at least those who now are not from the Greatest Generation, are finding the whole thing absolutely mystifying. What on earth are we doing over there? And if we weren't over there, why are we not defending our borders? Well, the liberals don't want to defend our borders because they won't be guilty to colored people. They don't want to defend the United States at all. And the other group, the conservatives, are for anything the United States does militarily, although they're not particularly touchy about protecting our borders. In fact, we are the first society in world history to say that the military has no business protecting the country's borders. That's insane, but then again, the entire mentality we got from all that obedience training and GI Bill stuff from World War II, the whole thing is insane. But we're going to have to go back to basics and see why it's insane. We can't proceed from what the Greatest Generation left us, worship them because somebody's uncle might be insulted otherwise, and proceed on the basis of the nutcase mentality that was imposed on them and which they accepted. Last week I did a program called DICTA. Don't interfere, call the authorities. That was the motto of the World War II generation, the group that calls itself the Greatest Generation. In the 1930s, when John Dillinger was out there and there was all sorts of violence, or at least public violence, we heard about it because it was so unusual. Nowadays, the average school has more violence in it than most communities during the 1930s. Of course, everybody says that poverty causes crime, but the Depression did not cause that much crime. But, of course, facts do get in the way, don't they? But in the 1930s, the last thing that people said should be done about bank robberies and so forth was to disarm everybody and wait until the police showed up. There were films of special kinds of guns. I remember one had a girl who had hidden guns on her, and she turned around and fired all kinds of shots. That was considered the normal way to deal with violence. Since World War II, the idea is that if your family might be attacked, first thing you need to do is be sure that you are disarmed. The whole gun control movement started, surprisingly enough, with the World War II generation. One thing that the political left and the political right today are in agreement about has to do with worshiping uniforms. You have the right to have a gun, not because you're in danger, but because you have a uniform on. Permit holders, since the concealed weapons permits went into effect over 10 years ago, have a much better record handling their guns than the police do. But the police have got costumes on, and therefore they have a right to be armed. This is accepted in America today, after 60 years of obedience training, but it certainly was not accepted earlier. In fact, the police were the ones who were not armed around 1900. The question was, who's going to pay for those guns? People had a right to carry a gun if they felt they were in danger. And people were not as threatened then as they are today. Funny thing about that. But, according to the logic that we have inherited from the World War II generation, guns go with uniforms. Now, the problem with that is that if guns go with uniforms, then you're halfway to a police state. Well, we've gotten halfway to a police state without even thinking about it. In fact, the average person today would wonder that I would dare say that the fact that you're running around in a costume gives you a special right to have a gun on you. Certain people should be banned from having guns, and they are, but I've worked in prisons. I've been in some pretty rough places, and I have yet to hear, even secondhand, of any criminal who could not get hold of a gun. The only person who can't carry a gun is someone who takes the law seriously. This is taken for granted. It is also insane. Neither you nor I have ever heard an even partially reasonable argument in favor of gun control. But that isn't the point. The point is that the World War II generation was raised and obedience trained on dicta. Don't interfere, call the authorities. Dicta happens to be the slogan of every police state that ever existed. There was certainly no shortage of weapons for the rioting blacks in New Orleans. There were good solid laws in New Orleans to keep honest people from having guns. There's certainly no shortage of guns in Harlem, I'll guarantee you that, in New York. Started with the premier anti-gun law, the Sullivan Act, 1945, which made it a year minimum sentence. By the way, liberals are against minimum sentencing for all crimes except for an honest citizen to be carrying a gun. That's an automatic one-year sentence. No liberal ever objected to that. Now, why did no liberal ever object to that? Well, we're right back to the same thing. The World War II generation made this an accepted rule. This was not an accepted rule before the World War II generation took over. Most people, I think about everybody but me, has no concept of just how bad the group that calls itself the greatest generation was. We take insanity as a basic rule of our society, since they went through their obedience training and imposed it on America as a whole. I've been in most parts of the world. I can't go into a lot of the ones that I have been in, but I've also known an awful lot of people who were on both sides during World War II. Outside of formal speeches where some foreigner had to say that American soldiers were brave and all that stuff, I have never heard anybody except members of the American Greatest Generation talk about what fine soldiers Americans were in World War II. Our men were miserable soldiers in World War II. We did have great supply and great artillery. And, of course, we were fighting Japan and Germany and Italy. We had Russia, the British Empire, and our own industrial might. We did manage to whip them. But the point is that as soldiers in World War II, the Greatest Generation, which now advertises that any one of them could beat 22 Waffen SS with one hand, they were pretty lousy soldiers as soldiers. Let me give them this, though. As one German said, we were speaking German, he said in English, they were very fair play. Well, we were fairer play than most Americans are, despite what liberals like to say. Pretty decent people. A lot of German children would walk right up to American troops who were just occupying their towns. They would walk up to the American troops, raise their hands in the air, and say in English, "I surrender, Schokolade." The American soldiers were known, were not frightening to people. So I consider that a good thing. But as soldiers, we weren't very good. And let me give you a news bulletin. The Greatest Generation was not the only group of people who ever fought a war. They just expected to be rewarded for it for the rest of their lives. Certainly their demands were higher than any other generation's. Out of 12 million Americans in uniform, 1 in 3 ever heard a hostile shot fired. So 4 million Americans were actually in combat. To some extent, I mean, to hear a hostile shot fired, and of course you've got to give credit to people who were never fired on, because if you were in the Merchant Marine or in the Navy, if you were fired on, particularly in the Merchant Marine, you were dead. That is to say, you got hit by a torpedo. And sitting in a ship for weeks waiting to die a cold death in the water is not necessarily better than being out in combat. So I'm trying not to be unfair. On the other hand, you have to give me a little bit of leeway here. I'm a little tired after over 50 years of listening to the World War II generation. The Greatest Generation. And remember, they wrote the book, and they did not deny it. I mean, they read the book, they bought the book, and writers write for the market. Brokaw wouldn't have written a book with that title if he didn't think they would snap it up. So if I'm being a little unfair, I don't think I am, it's because after over 50 years of listening to people surrender while beating their chest and talking about how wonderful they are, I'm a little tired of it, and I expect, if not equal time would be 50 years, but a few minutes of bringing this crowd down a little bit, not all the way down to where they belong, but down some. There is a very important political point in what I am saying, and that is something that on the right and the left, younger people are beginning to realize. Many younger people are opposing the Iraq War, and because of their parents or political issues or generally just people they hate, the right hates Teddy Kennedy and Bill Clinton, the left, hates George Bush, which is sort of like shooting a rabbit as far as I'm concerned. But from these habits, we have ourselves split into the right and to the left. But more and more, I notice that younger people on both sides of this so-called political divide are beginning to recognize that our present policies are pure insanity. On the so-called extreme right, there is a movement against this war for Israel, and on the extreme left, there is a movement against this war, which, oddly enough, they say is for Israel. Well, it is for Israel. There is a general revulsion against the fake two sides that we inherited from the World War II generation. The worshippers of the professors and the worshippers of the uniforms. This, to me, with my historical perspective, is not particularly mysterious. I don't think that the big issue today is whether the federal budget is big or small, or whether people have the right attitude toward religion or the free market or something. We've always had people who attacked religion and people who were for religion. This is nothing new historically. But if you just came on the scene yesterday, and it sounds, from what I hear from most of the email comments and so forth, everybody seems to have come on the stage yesterday, you find that they are completely at sea because they're still obsessed with this right-left bit. Actually, many, if not most, younger liberals or leftists are beginning to get over this idea of the white race is born to be guilty. In fact, I find more of that among conservatives than I do among liberals. European political leaders are the ones who keep criticizing Israel. I gave my book, Why Johnny Can't Think. I left it down in the guard area of my building for a black woman to read. She read every single word of it all in one night. In fact, the supervisor of the building sort of laughed and said, I wonder if she was guarding the building all that time. Well, anybody that can read my book is going to be able to guard the building and sit in one spot and make sure nobody dangerous comes in. She knows that. The supervisor knew that. But this black lady has told me repeatedly that she is my biggest fan. Now, this book of mine spends an awful lot of time talking about the danger to the white race, the program to get rid of the white race. She's supposed to hate me for saying that. But her attitude was, this is a white man. He's worried about the white race. So what else is new? A fellow who commented in my blog, who describes himself as a San Francisco liberal, said that I was the least racist person he had ever known about. I am against genocide, including genocide against the white race. I don't want to suppress anybody. In other words, I'm talking sense. So the divisions that we have are real. That is to say, black people want things that white people don't want, and liberals want things that conservatives don't want. But the mentalities that we have inherited from the World War II generation are not making a whole lot of sense to anybody. And I think if people will stop acting like they were born yesterday and start looking at the political, historical perspective here, we could make a lot of progress. We are divided because we don't have a dialogue with each other. And the one thing that terrifies the establishment is that we might develop a dialogue with each other. Minority groups want some money and some power. This is not really an unusual demand in the human animal. But the professors who rule what is called liberalism, leftism, and which the World War II generation worships, don't want the minorities to get any money. They want the money to go to professors who will then distribute the money. Well, professors, intellectuals, bureaucrats, whatever they want to call themselves. What I am not saying is that we are all one big happy family. Americans never have been one big happy family. In fact, the whole Constitution was set up so we could fight each other inside the rules. But we've got our lines pointed the wrong way. We have to get over this barrier between people who call themselves leftists and people who call themselves rightists, and save ourselves as groups. We're going to have a dialogue, and it's going to have to be in English. And it's not going to be big, thick books about conspiracies. What David Duke writes about Jewish supremacy is certainly not about a great conspiracy. In fact, the biggest problem David Duke has is the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. People expect some sort of crazed idea of a few people sitting around and forming a conspiracy. Then you open up David Duke's books and you find a perfectly normal person, although a genius, I hate to admit it, but I know him, so therefore I would love to put him down, but David Duke is a genius. But what they find is reasonableness. We have to get used to the fact that we represent the reasonable point of view. The only thing our masters can do at this point is to keep us from expressing it, from reaching each other. In New Orleans, at the convention, I believe it was last year, some people showed up with the metal things in their faces, and a lot of the people didn't know how to handle them. Actually, a lot of the people with these metal things in their faces, these rebels, are definitely on our side. They expected to be sort of isolated, and they were, but I ran up and shook hands with them and was glad to see them, because we need all the rebels we can get. And they were actually grateful. They wrote in Stormfront that I was nice and so forth and so on. Well, I'm a sweet guy. But it wasn't. It was really not just for them. It was for us. We need the rebels. We need the rebels with the green hair. We need the rebels with the little iron things in their faces. We need the ones who have those things in their tongues, those metal things in their tongues. We need everybody we can get, whether they call them right wing or left wing. You would be astonished that there are, in among all these self-styled radicals, and most of the so-called radicals are really just obedient to their professors. They learn that they've never outgrown their college education, like the World War II generation. But a lot of these people are actual rebels, and we are radicals. I always think it's kind of funny that anybody who is anti-liberal is called a conservative. I am about the least conservative human being you will ever meet in your life. And I am aching to get some of our fellow radicals away from this obsession with the right and the left. Our common enemy is what I call World War II conservatism. The William Buckley, the respectable conservatives, and of course the tired little liberals like Alan Combs, who fit into the political system that we inherited from the World War II generation. But the future lies in the simple fact that the World War II generation is dying out. Their ideas are dying out with them. And I am focusing on that absolutely wonderful development.